That's one of my problems, is that so many of the talks are recorded, that it's just so difficult to get a new story. Even when I say one here, you've already heard it before on the internet. So never mind. Even though there may be old stories, some of them are golden oldies. And today for the talk on meditation, again keeping the morning talk on meditation and the evening talk on how to get by in life. And the talk this morning, I'm going to use a simile which I mentioned a few days ago, just to reinforce how you meditate and what to expect. Already you've heard me say day after day after day, it's all about letting go, being still, not wanting anything, not getting rid of things, loving kindness, gentle, make peace, and you being waiting patiently in this moment, and then everything happens, rather than you going searching for things, or like the donkey running after the jury, and you don't do that, you just sit still, and everything happens. And a very beautiful simile which also helps you understand this and gives you another nuance into what we mean by the mind opening out is that simile of the thousand-petaled lotus. And many of you will know that the lotus is a Buddhist symbol. It's also a racing car, but we don't use that symbol. We go very slowly here in this retreat. It's also the IT company Lotus was actually founded by a Buddhist over the United States. But the lotus is an ancient symbol of Buddhism for many, many reasons. And I also mentioned yesterday that I try and mix up the teachings between the great Buddhist traditions of Vajrayana, Mahayana and Theravada. And I think in yesterday I mentioned Ajahn Brahm's version of the a poem of the third Zen patriarch. The path is easy when you don't have any preferences. In other words, by not wanting, by not having any judgment, you can't control anything and the mind becomes very, very peaceful. And today I'm going to use a very famous Vajrayana mantra, the most famous one of all, which you all know by heart, you've heard it so many times, the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. But how many of you know what that means? Because the beginning word and the last word, Om and Hum, is just the same as like Namo in Namo Tassa. It just means like reverence, worship, like a sadhu. And the two main words are the second and third word, Mani Padme, which is Sanskrit, but it's exactly the same in Pali. Pali and Sanskrit are often the same, and this is one of those instances where the Pali and the Sanskrit coincide. Mani Padme just literally means the jewel in the heart of the lotus. And that's what it means. It means like, hail, worship, sadhu to the jewel in the heart of the lotus. But what can that truly mean? If you look in lotus flowers, I've never found a jewel, no rubies, no diamonds, nothing in there. So it must be a metaphor. And this is the meaning of that metaphor, the great mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Because you all know lotuses. Lotuses are in the water, in the ponds, and sometimes in people's gardens, in fake ponds. And you know that that lotus at night time is closed up like a big ball. And you may also notice the outermost leaf or petal of the lotus is always rough and coarse, without hardly any fragrance at all. But inside that outermost layer of petals, inside that sheath, is the most beautiful, wonderful, fragrant petals, the inner petals of the lotus. But what happens in the early morning? The sun rises, and when the first rays of the sun warm the outermost petals of that lotus, it opens out. The outermost petals open to reveal the next layer of petals inside, which having been guarded from the wind and the sun and the dust, are much more beautiful and fragrant. And those layer of petals also receive the warmth and the light of the sun, which causes them to open out, to reveal the layer of petals inside, And they receive the warmth of the sun now so they can open out. And the petals of the lotus open layer by layer, with the next layer of petals inside the one which you can see right now. And as you go deeper and deeper into the lotus, the petals are more fragrant, more delicate, and more beautiful, which is the nature of that lotus. And that is exactly the same way that we meditate. The sun is our mind, and it warms the mind with mindfulness and compassion. Remember, in meditation, mindfulness is never enough. You need this combination, this magic mix of mindfulness and compassion. And so mindfulness and compassion warms this mind until it opens out layer by layer by layer. And that's actually how we meditate. But going back to the lotus when it's closed. When that lotus is fully closed, you look at that lotus and it is rough and it is dirty. It's got dust on the outside. And you think, no way can there be anything beautiful and wonderful inside this unlikely bud. In the same way that sometimes your mind is like that. It's tired, it's restless, it's angry, or whatever else your mind happens to be right now. And you look at your mind in this moment, you think, no way can there be anything beautiful and wonderful inside this mind. But there is. The mind which you have right now, the experience which you can almost half notice in this very moment, inside of that are all the beautiful stages of meditation. You don't need to abandon your sloth and torpor, your restlessness, your craziness, or as someone said the other day, your sexual fantasies. You don't need to abandon them, because inside, in the very middle of that unlikely source, you'll find all the beautiful states of meditation. So all you need to do is to warm this moment with mindfulness and compassion. And this is what you experience. This unlikely mind, just being kind, being mindful, opens out, just like the outermost petals of the lotus, to reveal the second layer of petals, present moment awareness. Present moment lies right inside whatever you're experiencing right now. Even within sexual fantasies, with dullness, with anger. If you go right into the center of that, you'll find now. And if you keep warming the present moment with mindfulness and compassion, it doesn't matter what you're experiencing right now. It may be painful, it may be unpleasant, but please open the door of your heart to this moment. Let it be. It's here. It's good enough. Be with it. And don't try and get rid of it so you can move on to something else. Stay with it. With mindfulness and compassion. Sometimes that mindfulness, I use the compassion part of it because compassion is always unconditional. Unconditional loving kindness. I will love you this moment no matter what you are. In the same way that my father said, the door of my heart's open to you, son, no matter what you ever turn out to be. It's unconditional. And so we also call this unconditional mindfulness. Because sometimes your mindfulness is conditional. You're mindful as long as it's working. You're mindful as long as it stays on the breath. You're mindful as long as something is getting more peaceful. But how many of you are mindful no matter what happens? And if you want to get into deep meditation, if you want to get into ordinary meditation, you have to develop unconditional mindfulness. To be aware no matter what you're aware of, even if it's unpleasant. That's where the compassion part comes. So in this moment, even if you've got a sore throat, if you feel very tired because you're sick, even if you feel this is a terrible day, I'm not going to get any meditation today, whatever it is you're feeling, unconditional mindfulness to this moment. And then you find, just like that second layer of petals, it opens out. It does it by itself. You just have to maintain your unconditional mindfulness in this present moment. And soon you go to that next layer of petals, which is usually silence, where the mind is not thinking, where there's not a commentary going on, where there is no names, there's no description, you're not writing an essay in your mind or trying to remember what's happening. You are totally silent, which means you're not talking back to reality. You're listening passively without giving a commentary or giving any orders. The mind is starting to become still. And of course, even at that second layer of petals, they're very beautiful, fragrant and delicate, as flower petals are. But you just stay there. With unconditional mindfulness to the silence, you're not interrupting. You're keeping your inner mouth shut, so you're not having a conversation inside. The inner speech has paused, and that opens out all by itself in time. When the compassion and the mindfulness have been maintained long enough, and who knows how long, I don't know how long it takes for the warmth of the sun to open a layer of petals, but I know it does eventually. And when it opens up, you find there your breath. And it's a wonderful thing as a meditator to realize I don't need to go seeking my breath. For many, many years I'd start my meditation watching the breath at the tip of the nose first of all. But then I used to get hay fever in England. And it was very frustrating because I was watching the tip of the nose and nothing was happening. My nose was blocked up. And I thought, my goodness, I can't meditate at this time of the year. And then somebody told me about meditation on your belly, watching the breath lift up your belly and let's see it rise and fall. But then when I became a monk, that was hopeless, because my belly was so close to my stomach. In the afternoon I felt so hungry. So that was very disappointing. And then eventually I realized you don't have to watch it anywhere. Just, you know, the breath. But still I would go looking for the breath. When I found out this method of meditation, so natural and beautiful, I didn't even look for the breath. I just stayed in this moment and warmed it with mindfulness and compassion. Silence came, and I just stayed with the silence, with unconditional mindfulness. And then out from that came my breath. And when that breath comes naturally, it's always very, very soft. When I look for the breath, it's coarse. When it comes naturally, it's very easy to watch because it's soft and beautiful. And that's what happened. I had this layer of petals. And I didn't seek it. It just came from itself, came off itself, just by maintaining this mindfulness and compassion. And I was just maintaining the mindfulness and compassion on this breath. And it opened out into the delightful breath, the beautiful breath. And some of you have already had that stage, which is a great stage of meditation to reach. The petals here are so delightful, it's very hard to take your attention away from them. At this stage, again, I called it the tipping point, a pivot point in meditation, because here your effort is not required any longer. The breath is beautiful, it's delightful, it's just having so much fun. You don't have to keep forcing your attention on it. The attention is grabbed by the delightful breath and kept there. Just anything which is beautiful, delightful and enjoyable, you just can't take your eyes away from it. And this is just happens because that delightful breath is right in the middle of this ordinary breath. And I mention this because so often when I describe these different stages of meditation, or you read the Anapanasati Sutta, and you read all these different stages, the 16 steps, we always think, oh, we have to throw away step number 3 to get to step number 4, as if we move from one room to another room. And that's not the way of meditation. The next stage is right within the stage you are in now, so you don't have to move out of this room. You just go to the center of this room, and there's another room in the middle. And that's the way of meditation. It's always going in, never going on. And that's a very important part of meditation, which I teach you. Never go on to the next level or the next stage. If you go on, it means you're abandoning where you are to go somewhere else, just like a journey. But you don't journey in meditation. You just stay put, you stay where you are, and you go in. You find in the middle of wherever you are is the next stage, just like the next layer of petals of the lotus is right within the ones you're observing right now. So you just get this delightful breath. The deeper you go into the lotus, the more beautiful it is, and the more fragrant it is. That's the nature of a lotus flower. And you go deeper within the delightful breath, and there the breath disappears. You know that sometimes people have asked me what happens when the breath disappears. I will tell you what happens when the breath disappears. This is a great way of understanding what on earth is happening. You have six senses, and you see the breath with two senses, with the tactile sensations of the body and also with the mind. Most of you, ordinary people, they know the breath as a physical sensation. But when that calms down and gets very still and peaceful, then that disappears and you're left with how the mind sees the breath, the mental sensation of breath. And at first you can't recognize the mental sensation of the breath because you're always used to knowing the breath as a tactile sensation, and now you're not feeling the breath, you're knowing the breath, and it's a totally different object, but it's still the breath. The closest simile I could give is as somebody's husband going off to Thailand to become a monk, as they are tomorrow. And when he becomes ordained, he wears different clothes, his hair is shaved off, and I'm sure even though the wife has been married to him for 20, 30 years or more, I don't know, but when she sees him for the first time, is that my husband? Because much of what she uses to recognize him is gone, his hair, his clothes. If ever you've seen a good friend ordained as a monk, the first time you see them, you've got to do a double take. Oh yeah, that's them. And it's the same with the mind, with the breath. When it's now seen through the mind rather than through the body, you do a double take. Is that the breath? Because many of its features by which you usually recognize it are not there anymore. Still the breath, but seen through a different sense door. So when your breath disappears, remember that it hasn't disappeared. It's just no longer are you seeing it as a tactile sensation. You're seeing it as a mental object. That's really important, because then you know what's going on. It's just you switch from one sense to another. And again, this is so important because the bodily senses have to be turned off. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. You may say that that is one of the whole purposes of meditation. To actually to calm the five senses down until they all turn off. And how do you calm the five senses so they all turn off? All you need to do is to keep still, because the brain only notices things which move. A good example, right now I'm going to ask you to notice the sensation of your saliva in your throat. Now you noticed it. Before I said it, you couldn't even notice it. Why? Because that sensation is constant, and because it's not doing anything of importance, your brain is efficient. It just turns off, so it doesn't even notice that sensation. The sensation of the aircon or the fans, after a while, you don't notice them because it's not changing. Your brain is only wired to notice things which change. So when you first sit down and meditate, you close your eyes, and what do you see? You see the blackness of the back of your eyelids. But because that does not change, because there's nothing going on there in the sense of sight, the sense of sight turns off. Maybe next time notice that. When you close your eyes, it's blackness. After a few seconds, you're not seeing anything at all. Sight has turned off. Smell and taste. As long as people aren't sort of passing wind, there's no change in the there's no change in the smell in this room. As long as you're not nibbling something, well, I've got my eyes closed. There's no change in taste. Those are very easy senses to turn off because nothing's happening there. It just stops. It turns off. And of course, the two most difficult of the five senses to turn off is the hearing and also the feeling. And the hearing, that is why we try to be still and not make too much noise at a meditation retreat. Because that's the hardest of the senses to turn off. It's why that you wake up in the morning with a gong or with an alarm clock which makes sound, because sound penetrates deep. And the reason why our brain is wired for sound, because that's our last line of defense. In the jungles, in the forests, we'd actually, even though we're half asleep, our sense of sound will still be ready to turn on at any moment in case a tiger or our enemy was about to creep up and kill us. So that's the last one which turns off because of protection and survival mechanism. Evolution over so many centuries has made it so that we will always hear as our last line of defense. It's the hardest one of all to turn off. And the feeling is not that hard to turn off. We just need to sit still. And when we sit still, nothing is moving in our body. The body disappears, as you've heard me say many times. Because you're not moving your body, or because there's not pain in the body, it vanishes, it disappears, which is one of the reasons why the Buddha taught the middle way, not to harm the body, not to cause pain in the body. Because if the body is aching or hurting, it will not turn off. You know, you've got a problem there. So which is why, please sit in a comfortable position. Sit on a chair. Again, if you haven't sat on a chair yet during this retreat, you know, you're probably stupid and you probably hurt. You've missed a chance to get into deep meditation because chairs are very comfortable. Chairs have evolved over technology, with technology over many decades to be comfortable. That's why you can sit in a chair with far less pain. So if you haven't got a deep meditation yet, try sitting in a chair. Don't be sort of proud and egotistical. No, I'm a real Buddhist. Only namby-pamby cream puffs use chairs. No, they're very wise. So you do that so that your body can be so relaxed you can't feel hardly any sensations in the body. So it can disappear, which is what it's supposed to do. The sense of touch is supposed to turn off. And of course, as I said, the one thing which is still moving, even though your body is still, is your breath going in and out. And that's a very tough one to calm down, because if you hold your breath, you die. But what usually happens is because you're watching the breath and it's gentle, you relax. So the breath is very smooth and subtle. Because it's smooth and subtle, after a while, the brain realizes nothing much is going on there, so it turns off. The sense of touch with the breath, and that's the last of the sense of touch, the last tactile sensation which turns off, and with it you're free of the body. And that's just a wonderful experience. The Buddha often said the five senses are on fire. They hurt, they're painful. So when the five senses turn off and your body disappears, it is an enormous relief. I'm getting older and older. There's always more aches and pains when you get older. And it's only when you can actually let go of the body in deep meditation you feel so free. Even the Buddha said that. When he got old, he said, the only time I'm free from physical suffering is when I get into the deep meditations. Because he was 80 and falling apart, like everyone else does. So being able to let go of the body is a huge relief. And this is what happens. So as one goes into this delightful breath, you go into the next layer of petals, which is the body has disappeared. And that's beautiful, that's so delightful. You just got the mind. And in that little petal, which is halfway between the nimittas and the delightful breath, where many of you say, I'm blank, I don't know what to watch, what should I be doing? Remember that simile I said, it's like the TV has been turned off and now you've just got the screen. Nothing's on the TV, nothing's happening, but the screen is still there, you can still watch the screen. The screen on which your consciousness is played out. And if you just stay there for a little while longer, not going on to another petal, because you've got to warm this petal of the breath having disappeared, with unconditional mindfulness, which means you're not asking for anything. Does this emptiness, this sense of the breath having disappeared, you just watch that. Unconditionally compassioning, the compassion at the door of my heart's open to this moment, even though there's hardly anything to watch. Stay with that. Because what happens, you go into it. Because right in the middle of that layer of petals is a nimitta petal. And that's when you really get into these incredibly fragrant, beautiful, unworldly layers of petals deep within yourself. Remember, even those nimitta petals are right in the center of this layer of petals you are experiencing right in this moment. You have nimittas, you just need to uncover them, open out your mind, rather than throw things away and go somewhere else. So you just stay with unconditional mindfulness, with compassion, just on this blackness, and the beautiful light appears. And what do? You just stay with it. Unconditional mindfulness, remember. Don't try and do anything with it. If you do something with it, it means your mindfulness is not unconditional. You want something. You're not just saying, the door of my heart's open to you no matter what you do, nimitta. You're saying, the door of my heart's open to you as long as you stay and get brighter and take me into jhana, nimitta. You're actually making conditions on this. That's why it disappears. So unconditional mindfulness. So like my father, the door, my heart's open to you, son, no matter where you go, no matter what you do. And you do that to the nimitta. And the nimitta stabilizes. You have an incredibly beautiful set of petals. And what do you do to get into a jhana? You just unconditional mindfulness on that nimitta, and it opens out. It opens out and you go within that nimitta. Which is the common experience, either you're watching that nimitta just covers you totally, or you feel yourself diving into it. Exactly the same which people experience when they again have that end-of-life experience, when they see the light. Going right in the center of it. Because remember, centering is where the next layer of petals lie. And then you go to these credible jhanas. And sometimes people, even though they haven't experienced any jhanas, they're always theoretical. They're wanting to say, well, how do you get from the first jhana to the second jhana, or the second jhana to the third jhana? The answer should be obvious right now, because the next layer of jhanas is right within the one you are experiencing now. The second jhana is a special case of the first jhana. It's like a room within a room. And the third jhana is a special case of the second. A room within a room within a room. The fourth jhana, a room within a room within a room within a room. Always going into the next layer of petals. So you're going into these amazing layers of petals, very close to the heart of a lotus. And they are so thin and gossamer, because there's hardly much going on here at all. The most subtle, beautiful experiences of your life. And they all open up. And in the middle of the fourth jhana, that's where you have the first immaterial jhana, the arupa states. Within the middle of the first is the second, the middle of the second is the third, the middle of the third arupa is the fourth. And that's the last layer of petals. When that opens out, that's where you see the jewel in the heart of the lotus. That's nibbana. That is one way of getting nibbana. Is actually going right through all the jhanas into the arupa states. The Buddha said once you get to that state, when you come out afterwards, no matter what happened to you before, you are an anagami or an arahat, because the Dharma is just impossible to not see. What Dharma is that? The Dharma of the jewel in the heart of the lotus. You know what that jewel is? Emptiness, just nothing there. Nothing at all. That is the jewel. To understand that, I'm going to be giving one of my Ajahn Chah stories. This great, great master who I was very privileged to live with for 9 years. Towards the end of his life, as many of you know, if you know the story of Ajahn Chah, he had a stroke. He had water on the brain which destroyed much of his brain. Just before he had that stroke, he had a shunt put into his brain, actually to drain some of the water into his stomach so that the pressure would be relieved. But it was too late, the damage was already starting. So for the last 9 years of his life, or 10 years, he was unable to speak, had to be cared for by all the monks and the doctors. unable to give any lessons by his mouth. But maybe a year before he had that stroke, we knew he was getting sick. He started complaining about dizziness. But we hadn't really found out what it was. But we did know, because as Western monks, we did look through all those old books, you know, the suttas and the Vinaya. And we did notice a strange thing, that in the time of the Buddha, all the monasteries would have a sauna. It's called a jantagara, literally a hot room or a steam room. And that was quite a revelation, because I always thought that saunas were invented in Sweden. They were not, they were invented in India a long time ago, and most Buddhist monasteries in the time of the Buddha had saunas for the health of the monks. So we thought, this is traditional, why not build a sauna for Ajahn Chah? They're very simple to build, and it means that we can look after the health of our teacher. But it wasn't just compassion, there was also some selfishness there. Because if we had a sauna in our monastery, it would mean that our teacher would have to visit more regularly than he usually did. And it worked perfectly, because he would visit every week for his sauna. And before he had his sauna, he would give all the monks a good Dhamma talk. So we had this great teacher coming once a week to give us a talk, and we would give him the sauna afterwards. It was one of those very brilliant deals. And that is the background to what happened, because on one day he gave a very brilliant Dhamma talk. And if ever I do that, or if any of you ever hear a really good Dhamma talk, you get so inspired. Please don't throw that inspiration away, because that is huge energy to drive you deep into meditation. When you're really inspired by a good Dhamma talk or something wonderful has happened, use that. Sit down and watch your breath or whatever you do in your meditation. And you find the inspiration will give you such a big boost, you'll have a wonderful meditation. And of course, I know the way of meditation well enough by then. When Ajahn Chah gave a really inspiring talk which really touched me, instead of doing my services to my teacher by going to the sauna and helping him out, I went to the back of the hall where no one would see me, sat down and went to meditate. And it worked, because the inspiration was so strong, I got into a really nice deep state of meditation, having a wonderful time. And of course, in those states of meditation, you don't know how many minutes go by. You're in timeless state. So when I came out of my meditation, and I looked around, no one was around. And I just thought, maybe, I still have time to do some duties for my teacher. It was actually probably about 2 hours went by. So I got up and started walking towards the sauna. And as I walked along the path towards the sauna, I realized I was too late, because I saw Ajahn Chah coming towards me with 2 Thai lay people, his attendants, who were going to take him back to the car and drive him back to his monastery. But it was too late to turn around. I was going to cross paths with Ajahn Chah. He was coming towards me, we were going to meet, and I would have to get out of the way to let him pass. But as we came close, you saw Ajahn Chah looking at you, right through you. I realized he'd noticed I'd had a very good meditation. He could see the signs. And he was checking me out from within. Monks can read people's minds, but they don't usually do that, because your mind is not worth reading. I think you know what I mean. But every now and again, you see like a disciple who really has done something. And then you're interested, what have they done? And you go inside and check them out. And that's what Ajahn Chah did. And he saw I just emerged from a very deep meditation. And that is the time your mind is open, malleable, ready to become enlightened. So he decided to give it everything he had and try and enlighten his stupid student. He looked at me fiercely, with eyes so you can't take your gaze away from him. And he said, "Brahma Wangso, why?" He asked me the question, why? It was very fierce, but kind, but incredibly forceful. And then my answer came out, "I don't know." Because look, I was a stupid disciple, you know, only about 6 or 7, 8 years as a monk. It takes a while before you get any wisdom, and I didn't have any yet. And of course, a great monk never scolds you. Even though it's the most stupid answer, he never thought, you idiot monk, you stupid monk, all these years I've taught you and that's the best you can come up with. Oh, I'm just, all this hard work I've done, totally wasted on people like you, get out of here. He never scolds you like that. He just burst out laughing. So great monks, if you come along and say, oh, you know, I've just, yesterday evening I went out to dinner and then I watched a movie and I was supposed to be on 8 precepts and I did all these terrible things, and you come and tell me that, if I'm a great monk, I just burst out laughing. I think, well, that's really funny. You never scold, because it's just the nature of human beings, just to be a bit sort of naughty. But he laughed. And then I thought I was relieved, but no. He screwed up his face again and got me with those eyes and said, Brahma Wangsa, if anyone asks you that question again, this is the answer. And I was really interested, because this great monk was going to give me a personal teaching on the deepest of dhammas. Just a simple question why, and what the answer to the question why was. And I couldn't wait. And he said, the answer to the question why is there's nothing. There's nothing. In time, my mi'alai. There's nothing. And then he looked at me again and said, do you understand? And I said, yes. And he said, no, you don't. And then he laughed and walked away. That was a great encounter. But those are one of the encounters you always remember and you keep, you know, just reflecting on it in your mind again and again and again. The answer to the question why was, there's nothing. My mirai. The emptiness, nothing there. Anatta, sunyata, all these words. And he just put it in such a simple and powerful way. And that's the jewel in the heart of the lotus. You open it all out and there's nothing there. Nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. And that was a wonderful simile of the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Not only does it give you an understanding of what nirvana is, it also gives you an understanding that nirvana is right in the center of you right now in this moment. You've got nirvana. You just need to unfold everything to see what's inside. See what's inside this moment. Deep, 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 deep. Always going inwards. And the reason why people never get into deep meditation or see nirvana, because they never go inwards, they always go onwards. Always on to the next experience, on to the next retreat, on to the next meal, on to the next day, on to the next year. We go on to the next life. We never actually go into anything, because we never stay still long enough to go in. We're always on the move. Which is why stillness is a deep path to wisdom. It's natural, this is what you do. To give you another simile. The next time, again, I said there's a TV in my room, I sometimes look at it, but not when it's turned on. I never turn TVs on. But if you ever turn a TV set on, you will notice when you first turn the TV on, so the edges of the screen. You may notice like a flower pot on top of the TV if you've got a flower pot on top. You may notice some magazines underneath or things at the side. But after a few seconds, you will realize you can't notice even the edges of the screen anymore, because the mind is totally focused on the center of the TV screen. Which is why I've told many disciples, you don't need to buy huge plasma screen TVs, which are about 6 foot wide. That is a total waste of money, because the only time you notice how big it is when it's not turned on. When it's turned on, you're in the center of the screen, And you can have one of those small TV screens like on the back of aircraft seats. It will look exactly the same to your mind. Your mind will fit in to just inside the screen, and you won't notice the edges, nor will you notice how big that screen is. The way of perception is when you are looking, you just go in. You focus in to where the action is. And the action is not on the edges of the screen. If you started a new company to have designer TV sets, not oblong, but circular. Has anyone ever made a circular TV screen yet? You could be the first one. You can get the patent. It could be weird shaped TV sets, like a diamond or like a triangle. It doesn't matter what the shape is, because as soon as you turn it on, you will not notice the shape anymore. You'll be in the center of the screen. That's the nature of perception. So that when you're looking at me, if you really focus on my nose, soon what's to the left and right of my head vanish. If you're still focusing on my nose, my torso disappears and you cannot see my hands. This is what happens. The nature of the mind is to focus in the center and everything on the outside disappears. You're going in. That's a very helpful simile, because when you are meditating, there will always be distractions. There may be thoughts, there may be problems. But the way to deal with distractions and problems is not make them the center of your screen. For example, you're watching your breath and there's a noise of someone banging the door. If you can keep that noise on the edge of the screen out here somewhere, because the center of your screen is totally taken up with the breath, that will not disturb you. What many people do though, they're watching the breath and somebody bangs the door, and straight away the noise of the door banging becomes the center of your screen. You've lost the breath and now you've got a distraction. In the same way, when you're watching a real movie on the TV, and your husband comes and says, "Darling, there's a telephone call for you," and the movie hasn't ended yet. You just can't hear it. It's on the edge of the screen. But certainly you don't take it into the center of your screen because the movie hasn't finished yet. So it's not a distraction to you at all. Remember how to deal with distractions. Never pull them to the center of your screen of attention. Then you can find you can deal with any type of distraction whatsoever. They're always out here, but my center is on, say, the breath. I mentioned that's what I did with the mosquitoes biting me in Thailand. Yeah, they could feel them, but they were over on the edge and my center was on the breath and I wouldn't move from the center of the breath, because if I did, I'd be centering on the terrible feeling of mosquitoes and it would really be irritating. I kept the center on the breath and soon what's on the edge falls off my screen. In a while I couldn't even feel the mosquitoes. Exactly the same way, after a while you can't see the edges of your TV screen. They disappear. Or you see a big movie theatre. It's years since I went to a movie theatre. But even there, it's a huge screen. But it actually looks exactly the same as if you see a movie on a small screen. The experience is the same. It's the nature of the brain. When I explained that, and a couple of people knew enough about psychology to realize what I was actually saying is true, they were going to buy a big plasma screen TV for their house. But they decided to stick with their small screen and give the rest as a donation to my retreat center. Really, I won that one. Because you really don't need it. The experience is exactly the same. Test it out, try it out. But it shows you what actually focusing really is. When you understand what that focusing is, it means you understand how your brain works and how you get into deep states of meditation. And how you deal with the many distractions which you have in life. And how you deal with, and not just how to get into deep meditation, because you all heard that all of these talks I've been telling you how to get into deep states of meditation. And it was only just the one talk, you know, that I said how that relates to doing insight. But I never actually finished that off, because when I talked about the Anapanasati Sutta, I only got to stage number 12, which is the jhanas with Mochi Anchitang. never sort of talked about the last four stages of Anapana. You know, that's actually where you start to reflect on what has just happened. You've just been in the jhana, and you start to see just the sorts of things which have happened. Things like the anicca. Very few people really know what anicca means. Anicca is not rise and fall. Anyone can see rise and fall. What anicca means is like you're looking at, say, sitting by a lake. And you see the waves go up, the waves go down. That is not anicca. That is superficial. So you're sitting by the lake and you see the waves go up and the waves go down. The waves go up, the waves go down. And you're sitting there and after a few minutes the whole lake vanishes. It's gone. It's disappeared. And lakes aren't supposed to do that. That's anicca. Things which were always there, which were constant, are no longer there. Now those are the sort of insights which are like a kick up the backside to say, my goodness, what I relied on is unreliable. Because I first understood the meaning of anicca when I started again reading some of the suttas in Vinaya in Pali. And it's not that hard to learn Pali. Now I had a good brain, so I could easily learn Pali. And then I started reading the Vinaya, because the Vinaya is like the rules for monks, but there's a lot of Dharma in that Vinaya. And one of the things I came across is just a certain type of meals which the lay people would serve to the monks. And there was something in there called nicca food. Anicca is the opposite. This is nicca food. And nicca food would happen when somebody, say, Engchai, came to the monastery every Tuesday. Tuesday was his day when he would bring food. So it was a regular supply of food once every Tuesday. Or it could be Daddy comes every Wednesday. So it was a regular supply of food. And that was nicca. It has a regular, always there, relied upon. And anicca means the opposite. Something which is always there, regular, certain. Gone. Just like a lake. Or the other simile I gave, going back to the TV set. You have a TV set, and the TV set's got the five channels. It's got sight channel, sound channel, smell, taste, touch channel, or even the sixth channel, mind channel. And you're watching the TV, and sure, they get different programs, and you surf from channel to channel. Yeah, it's all this impermanence there. But as you're watching the different channels on the TV, you find the TV vanishes. 1 minute it was there, and the whole TV set, together with the screen, is gone. And that's not covered by the warranty. Said, my goodness, what's happening? Am I going mad? No, things which were always there, the screen on which your life has been played out, has gone. That is weird. But that's what anicca is like. As I mentioned in the jhanas, the screen, the five sense screens. Yeah, sometimes nothing's being played on those screens. Sometimes you're not seeing, you're not hearing, not smelling, you're not tasting, you're not having any tactile sensations, but the screen is there, it's just the TV's turned off. But when the whole screen vanishes, the sense has not just been turned off, it's disappeared. Now that is weird. Then you know these things are not me, not mine, not a self. So anicca, that's what happens after jhanas. Things have just vanished, they're gone. Viraga. Viraga is actually not just dispassion. It has two meanings in Pali. The most interesting one is fading away. You see just your body and even your will and your consciousness fading away. It's disappearing. That's why the latest book, which is going to be published, it's actually the manuscript is with Wisdom Publications in Boston, New York. It's a series of talks which I gave to monks, and the monks have actually chosen the title, and it's called The Art of Vanishing by Ajahn Brahm. And that's what we do. We vanish. We disappear. Bye-bye. That's nirvana. And nirodha, cessation. That's what happens when the vanishing is complete. Things stop. And it's great when things stop. The word stop is a powerful word which was used by the Buddha. And, I know this is not really true, but you know one of the greatest Buddhist statues? Just like the policeman. Stop. That's not what it really means. It's like the Abhaya Mudra, fearlessness. But, I like to say it stop, because that's actually what the Buddha said to Angulimala. He said, stop, Angulimala. And it wasn't just stop breaking his precepts. It was far more profound than that, to get Angulimala enlightened. It was stop running physically. Stop running mentally. Stop, just like the donkey stops. And Angulimala was smart enough. He did stop, totally stop. And that's why the durian came into his mouth and became enlightened. There's this great story of this little novice in Wat Pa Phong many, many, many years ago. And I think I've already mentioned to you, when Ajahn Chah used to give talks, it was boring. He would say so much rubbish. If I repeat stories, nowhere near like Ajahn Chah would repeat the same old story again and again and again and again. And if you ever read a book of Ajahn Chah's, you know, the great sayings of Ajahn Chah, that has been filtered. The very, very best, the creme de la creme, and all the other rubbish has been taken out. And I say that out of great respect to my teacher, but sitting there listening to him give a talk for 5 hours, you know, it was such boring stuff, but it was worth it, because every now and again he'd say something really, really profound. But the best teachings, as I mentioned earlier, came from just the little one-liners when he was with you, rather than his formal talks. But I do remember that this particular case, there was Ajahn Chah giving one of his boring sermons for hour after hour after hour in the main hall of Wat Pa Phong in front of the monks, and every now and again you'd have these little novice monks. And he had a little novice monk maybe about 11 or 12 years of age. And, you know, sometimes those little novice monks in Thailand were there because they had no family or their father had abandoned them and this was the only place they could go. So as a little novice monk there listening and getting bored out of his skull and thinking, look, you know, I'm only a little novice. I didn't really want to become a monk. I got no choice. Maybe those other guys, they're interested in this, but I'm not interested at all. I want to go to bed. I'm a young man. I need my sleep. Not like these tough guys. I'm 11 or 12 years. I'm now a young person. I should be allowed to go to sleep. And he started getting very upset and thinking all these thoughts. And then he started getting into this, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? You know, it's 9 o'clock. When is he going to stop? 9:05. When is he going to stop? And he became obsessed with this thought, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? And after torturing himself for a long time, was when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? This little novice had an insight, and a lot of times insights is just turning things around to look at it from the other way. And his insight was, when am I going to stop? And just that one thought, when am I going to stop? And he stopped. When he opened his eyes, it was early morning. He sat through the night. All the monks had long gone, on arms round or whatever. Now, it was the first time this little novice had a very beautiful meditation. He'd stopped and blissed out. So, if you haven't got any bliss states yet, just tell yourself, when am I going to stop? When am I going to stop? Come on, stop. And of course, he didn't hear the chanting at the end of the talk. He didn't hear the gong go. He didn't hear all the monks pack up their stuff and walk out of the room. He was deep inside having a wonderful time. Why? Because he knew how to stop. Now, all these little explanations which I'm giving you, whether it's the simile of the 1,000-petal lotus and the jewel in the heart of that lotus, whether it's a story of stopping, whether it's a story of anicca, that things are always there, now no longer there, they disappeared. All of those is teaching you just how to meditate and what happens when you do meditate. You stop and things go, they vanish. And you get into more and more refined, blissful, beautiful states of mind. And little by little, giving you all that information, I'm just teaching the same thing from different angles, day after day after day. And every time I teach like this, I'm giving another piece of the jigsaw puzzle, or rather, another way of looking at the same thing. So, the main lesson from this talk today is unconditional mindfulness. Stay with whatever you've got. Doesn't care what it is. Even sexual fantasies. Even most stupid thoughts. Even psychotic plans to come to my room tonight and chop me up with an axe. I don't care what you're thinking right now. Stay with it. Don't throw it away. But go into its center. And in the center of the thought to chop me up with an axe tonight, I better lock my door just in case. In the center of that thought, you'll find all the jhanas, nimittas, and enlightenment. There is a jewel in the heart of the wanting to chop me up with an axe thought. And that's called nibbana. Stay there, go deep in, and there you'll find the path of meditation and insight. So that's the talk for this morning. Another day, another talk. There are some questions here, but only three, thank goodness. Oh, I should make the announcement if anyone goes. Because this up for another one. This afternoon, I'm supposed to be going off to the Malaysian Buddhist Cooperative for their birthday celebrations or whatever. Anyway, so I'll be out most of this afternoon. But so anyone who wants interviews, I'll be in here 4:30. So interviews, 1 hour delay. So 4:30 to whenever you're finished. So I won't be up here at 2 o'clock meditating. At 4:30 we have the interviews this afternoon. Dear Ajahn, many, many thanks for your teachings. When a person had a sudden enlightenment, they passed through the third, fourth jhanas in one go. There's no such thing as a sudden enlightenment. No more is there a sudden getting of your bachelor's or master's degrees. However, I've gone to many people's houses and seen these photographs of their son or their daughter receiving a degree. And that's all I've seen. I've just seen a photograph of that one moment when they got the parchment saying they've got a degree. I've never seen any photographs of when they were doing their final exams. Never seen the photographs of when they were attending lectures. Never seen the photographs of them sitting in their room, typing out their essays. You only see the final bit when they got the degree. So on the basis of that information, all you need to get a degree these days is to turn up at one of these ceremonies looking like a penguin with a funny hat on. And hopefully someone will call your name and give you the parchment. That's all you need. Sudden getting a degree. Sudden graduation. There is no such thing as sudden graduation, even though the graduation happens on a particular time, on a particular day, in a particular year. But that graduation can only come about because of many, many causes and conditions which happened before, which are not recorded. In the same way that people who so-called got sudden enlightenment, that is just the straw which breaks the camel's back, the last little piece. But remember, they had to work a lot of years, lifetimes, to get to that point where just that one little teaching got them over the edge into enlightenment. So it really wasn't sudden enlightenment. No more than it's a sudden graduation to get your degree. Somebody else on here as well. In yoga, they mention about using the kundalini energy to gain enlightenment. How is this compared to jhanas? That is actually one thing I disagree with in yoga, because the kundalini is getting that mental energy and keeping it in your body. And that's, I think, quite dangerous. So when you get into these deep states of meditation, you get huge amounts of energy, but keep it in your mind. Because if it goes into your body, you lose a lot of this great mental joy and power as it just goes into your body instead of going into the mind. I told my monks it's like having a leaky bucket. So the bucket never fills because it drips out. So if you can let go of the body as soon as possible in meditation, when the energy, the piti sukha, the joy, the power starts coming, it stays in the sixth sense in the mind rather than leaking out into the body. And then you get far deeper in meditation. How much is your Perth 9-day meditation retreat cost? If you come to a 9-day meditation retreat in Perth, it is priceless. Many years ago, I said things were free. And because I said they were free, people took advantage. They thought it was worthless. There's this great story of somebody. It was an American lady who rang up Ajahn Sumedho years ago. He told me this story. She rang him up and said, I hear you teach meditation. He said, yes, ma'am, I teach meditation. He's a great meditation teacher. How much do you charge? He said, nothing, it's for free. She said, well, you can't be any good then, and hung up the phone. It's true, isn't it? Because many people think if it's for free, it's got no worth, no value, so they go somewhere else. But if you go teach a meditation retreat, if I taught this retreat and say it's $1,000 per person to come on an Ajahn Brahm retreat, you know, there'll be many people coming. You know why? Because they go, my goodness, $1,000? That must be special. And they will come. And I think that's fraud. Because I was giving all these things for free. I never sort of paid Ajahn Chah anything for tuition fees. So I got it for free. I don't see why I can't give it to other people for free also. So the Vajranagar Meditation Retreat Center is totally free. You don't pay a dime. You can leave a donation afterwards, which most people do, but it's no cost. Just curious, if we give unlimited compassion to our mind, will the mind be pampered, become wild? Can we use both soft and hard strategy? No, this is not like the LA police. Actually, I know a joke about that. It's one of my favourite jokes. So, no, if you give it compassion, it won't be pampered. In fact, if you give it compassion, compassion is the way to peace. And you can't do too much compassion. The Buddha was compassionate and he got many, many enlightened beings. I've been having very strong emotional dreams since the start of this retreat. Why is that so? By the way, thank you so much for being a great healer and teacher. Yes, I deserve that. Last but not least, I would like to thank Enchai and his team for organizing a great retreat. And you deserve that too. Very good. So the emotional dreams depends whether they're strong good emotions or strong bad emotions. So if it's good emotions like compassion, like kindness, like love, so you dream of just being this wonderful compassionate being who's going to help and serve the whole world. If you dream of like beautiful love, unconditional to all sentient beings. If you dream of beautiful peace and solving all the problems of the world by being a peacemaker. And those emotional dreams, brilliant, that's what's supposed to happen. But if they're negative emotional dreams, just like, you know, dreaming of killing all the organizers because they didn't give you the right place to sleep. Now, if those bad emotional dreams, there's a trouble there. And one of those troubles is sometimes because if you try the hard meditations of suppression, which sometimes people do, they're going to push aside all these restless thoughts and just go onto the breath. Push aside, and just go onto the breath. Then that pushing aside, that suppression, actually builds up the power of the negative emotions. So it's much better just to let things be. Be kind, be gentle, and don't be too forceful. Otherwise you get the negative emotions coming out in your dreams. You suppress them. When programming our mind to look out for sloth and torpor, how do we avoid sloth and torpor when it sets in and this is something physical and we may be overwhelmed by it? Actually, you see it coming. So when you program your mind to look out for it, now you see your mind and body just getting a little bit dull, a little bit bored, it's not interested anymore, and it's just letting go in the path of sloth and torpor. Not letting go in the path of mindfulness, but letting go of the path, I just want to dull out. You can see that happening. That's that fork in the road I was talking about. So one path is just letting go of mindfulness and everything because you're bored, you just want to sort of blank out for a while. And that's sloth and torpor. The other one is, yes, you're letting go of many of the obstacles, but you're not letting go of mindfulness. You're keeping the mindfulness strong. And as you see that fork in the road coming, and you know which one you want to take. There are obviously sometimes you get sloth and torpor because you haven't slept well at night or because you're sick or whatever, and that stuff is just physical, so you can just let that one be, rest some more. But most of the sloth and torpor people experience, especially at this stage of the retreat, is the sort of dullness and boredom type, which can be avoided. So there we go. That's any questions from the floor before we go on to the interviews? Going? No, it wasn't fast enough. Okay, yes. Okay, how much study should you do compared to practice? Somebody once asked Ajahn Chah that. And he said the practice of meditation, keeping precepts, doing generous acts, he said that's like the rice and curry, your main meal. And the study is like the sweets you have afterwards. So the most important thing is a practical aspect of your path. Meditating, joining retreats, practicing your precepts, doing service, giving donations, that sort of stuff. That is the main course, the staple of your Buddhist life. And the study, he said, that's the sweets which come afterwards. If all you do is just to eat sweets, then you're going to get diabetes, you're going to get very sick. And of course you know that some people study, and then they hardly have any idea of what Buddhism is. So make sure it's well balanced. So if you do go to that university, make sure you do lots and lots of meditation, you actually practice a lot. And then you'll find out that you will have a very balanced diet as a Buddhist. But again, if you just sort of eat rice and curry and you don't eat some fruits afterwards, again, that's not a balanced diet afterwards either. So do a little bit of study as well. But you know, you don't have to study that much. One of the things which, I know this is controversial, but look, in the suttas, the Buddha once gave the simile of the Simsapa leaves. You know, he picked up some leaves in his hand, and this was in a forest of Simsapa trees, and he said, which are more, the leaves in my hand or the leaves in this great forest? And it's obvious, the leaves in the great forest are a billion times more than the leaves in your hand. He said, just the same amounts of things which I haven't taught you compared to what I have taught you. They're just like the leaves in the great forest compared to the leaves in my hand. But, he said, the reason I haven't taught you those other things is because they're not helpful to enlightenment. I've taught you everything which is necessary for enlightenment. You don't need anything more. I love that little teaching because that taught me that, you know, what's in, say, those books, you know, in the suttas, that is all you need. And that's what the Buddha taught. He said everything extra is not necessary at all. So I would actually encourage people, if you're going to do some study, study the suttas. Controversial, but this is strong evidence supporting it. The Buddha never taught the Abhidhamma. In the Vinaya Pitaka, they have the account of the first council held by Mahakasapa, the 500 Arahats. The same is in all the other recensions of the first council and all the other traditions, such as in the Mahayana Agamas. It said very clearly there that Upali recited the Vinaya and Ananda recited the Pancha Nikaya, the five Nikayas, which everybody knows as Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, and Guttara Nikaya, and Kudika Nikaya. There's no mention at all of Abhidhamma at all. And as many people, modern scholars have pointed out, the language of the Abhidhamma is much, much later than the language of the suttas. In the same way, if I gave you three books, I gave you, say, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, and I gave you Charles Dickens, say Oliver Twist, and I gave you Harry Potter book, you'd soon be able to find out which was early, which was later. The language, the vocabulary, changes with generations. And it doesn't take much for a scholar to look at a text and date it because of the language, the grammar, and the vocabulary. And they have done that to the Abhidhamma. They've dated it maybe 100 years after the time of the Buddha. Not the time of the Buddha. And that's great relief, because the Abhidhamma is very complex, very large, and not necessary. Yes? Yeah? No, I would just do both, meditation and also some studies. Because, you know, there's many teachers, there's me, there's other teachers, I say one thing, another teacher says another thing. So who should you believe? Please don't believe me, don't believe the other teacher. Believe what's actually in those books. That's the last standard which we can actually see what is real Buddhism, what isn't. Because this is the teachings of Ajahn Brahm. That's the teachings of the Buddha. And I respect that far more. So you had a question for coming in front, yeah? It's always like what I said earlier, if you ever get any problem like that, do the programming of mindfulness. So if I get to any stage, I won't disturb it by saying, I forgot my counting. And then you won't do that anymore. But remember, that wasn't total emptiness. It's getting on the way, but there's more emptiness to come. More petals to open out. But stay where you are. And go deeper. And deeper. And deeper. Very good. Any more questions before we start the interviews? Yes, last question, yeah. What sutta is actually the best sutras to begin with is the middle length things, little brown book, the fourth from the end there, because they're not that long, but they've got some very juicy teachings inside. Yeah, Majjhima Nikaya, middle length discourses of the Buddha. That's a really good one to start with. And then it really opens your mind. My goodness, this is what the Buddha actually taught. And so they have really, really excellent teachings in there. And it's not a bad translation.